Then this work paper in the Pacific Theatre is a commentary on Esther. This is a detailed analysis of the Book of Esther. The implications contained in the Book of Esther have great significance to the modern Christianity. And the paper uses the rabbinical commentaries and exposes them to Christian biblical exposition, which produces some significant results. This commentary is on the Book of Esther. As we said, it's a wonderful story about a lady who became Queen of Persia, or is a story about the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, or is both? We will find out from the commentary that it is both. What it teaches us is how we will inherit the kingdom of God. It is the equivalent of a time span or plan of salvation for the Jews so that the sequence is understood. It is very carefully concealed, often by the rabbis themselves, because it has information that is quite extraordinary. There are a number of things which require discussion. The king involved is Ahasuerus. God is nowhere mentioned in this book. This fact is quite extraordinary, and the reason for this is because the controlling of affairs or the power of God is exercised under the identity of Ahasuerus. So there is no necessity for God to be named, because the kingdom and the kingship rests in the entity who exercised the power of God. Ahasuerus adopts that position in the story as it unfolds, especially in the millennial perspective. The actors themselves take on an enormous significance in relation to the church, Christ and the fallen host, and the time sequence of the end. Ahasuerus is generally recognized as being identical with Xerxes, who reigned from 485 to 464 BCE. The Hebrew, Ahasuerus, is an attempt to represent the Persian word Kushayasha, from which the Greeks derive the name of Xerxes. You see that in the Sonsino commentary in the Bible, footnote to verse 1. They were difficult pronunciations, and the names are transliterations. The king is Xerxes. He is the king in Ezra 4, who reigned after Darius the First and before Artaxerxes, who stopped the construction of the temple. That's Artaxerxes the First. Ezra 4 has a sequence of the building of the temple. It says in Ezra 4, verses 4 to 5, the people in the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So they frustrated or stopped construction on the temple of the in the reign of Cyrus, until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. He was not Darius the First. Modern Judaism and modern Christianity have a vested interest in making the temple complete in the reign of Darius the First. The temple was not and could not have been completed in the reign of Darius the First at all. This is a direct contradiction to the express words of the Bible. It says at verse 6, and in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, there rose an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. The rabbinical commentaries on the Midrash on Esther say he stopped construction on the temple in the beginning of his reign and promulgated the decree against the Jews in his later years. And you'll see that in the Sonsino Midrashic approach to Esther, page 125. That is why attempts are made to make Ahasuerus Cambyses, who was the son of Cyrus, so they fit the construction of the temple in the reign of Darius the First. However, it goes on in verse 7 to say, in Ezra 4, verse 7 to 24, in the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam and Mithridath and Tabeel and the rest of their associates wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. The letter was written in Aramaic and translated. Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes, the king, as follows. Then wrote Rehum, the commander, Shimshai, the scribe, and the rest of their associates, the judges, the governors, the officials, the Persians, the men of Erech, the Babylonians, the men of Susa, that is, the Elamites, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Osnapor deported and settled in the cities of Samaria and in the rest of the Babylonian province or the provinces beyond the river. And now this is a copy of the letter that they sent to Artaxerxes the king. Your servants, the men of the provinces beyond the river, send greetings. And now be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have gone to Jerusalem, They are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city, and they are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. Now be it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls finished, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and the royal revenue will be impaired. Now because we eat the salt of the palace, and it is not fitting for us to witness the king's dishonor, therefore we send and inform the king, in order that search be made in the book of the records to your fathers. You will find in the book of this of the records and learn that this city is a rebellious city, hurtful to kings and provinces, and that sedition was stirred up in it from old. That is why this city was laid waste. We made known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls finished, you will then have no possession in the province beyond the river. The king sent an answer to Rehum the commander and Shimshai the scribe and the rest of his associates who live in Samaria and the rest of the provinces beyond the river. Greeting. And now, the letter which you sent to us has been plainly read before me, and I made a decree, and search has been made, and it has been found that this city from of old has risen against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been made in it. And mighty kings have been over Jerusalem, who ruled over the whole province beyond the river, to whom tribute, custom, and toll were paid. Therefore make a decree that these men be made to cease, and that the city be not rebuilt until the decree is made by me. And take care not to be slack in this matter. Why should damage go to the hurt of the king? Then when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their associates, they went in haste to the Jews at Jerusalem, and by force and power made them cease. And the work on the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, stopped, and it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So quite simply, Ahasuerus was petitioned in the court, also from the Midrash, to stop construction, and Artaxerxes, who followed him, was also petitioned, according to the Bible in Ezra 4:24, work on the house of God stopped until the reign of Darius the Persian. Now it follows, as night to day, that the Darius, the Persian referred to in verse 24, cannot be Darius the First, who ruled before both King Xerxes and King Artaxerxes. That is King Artaxerxes the First. The significance of this is that attempts are made to confine construction of the temple to the reign of a king who reigned two reigns before Artaxerxes and prior to Ahasuerus, the king in question here. There is significance in the book of Esther 4, or relating to the completion of the temple of King Solomon, which is important. The concepts of the names are important. There were other kings named Ahasuerus. The Sonsino and the rabbinical commentaries gives understanding of what is meant by these texts. Esther 1:1 says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this is Ahasuerus, "which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces." Now the listing of the provinces is being over 7 and 20 and 100 provinces. Darius the First was set up over a kingdom and set the kingdom into 120 satraps, and the inscriptions list approximately 127 nations according to Marcus and the Sonsino. In Daniel 6:2, the 120 satraps are mentioned, so we are dealing with the possibility that we're looking at a sequence of not 127, but at 7 principal governors and 120 satraps. That might be more evident perhaps later. The areas are concerned are from Ethiopia to India, and the India here is from the Hebrew Hodu, which is the Indus Basin. Ethiopia was conquered by Cambyses, king of Persia, from 529 to 522 before the current era. So all these things are set up from Cambyses and Darius. Thus, we are looking at Xerxes, who has taken over the kingdoms established from Ethiopia by Cambyses and the provinces by Darius. So this king is the one who reigns after Darius, and thus must be Xerxes. Esther 1:2 says that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace. 1:3 says in the third year of his reign he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. In verse 4 we read that he said, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom, the honor of his excellent majesty, many days, even 104 days. Here we're looking at a 180-day party. Now, these feasts of the Persians were commemorative feasts, which were extraordinarily luxurious. One of the reasons for the injunctions against holding birthdays was because the holding of birthdays was a custom of the Persians derived from the worship of Ishtar. And this has been discussed in the paper on birthdays, number 287. They sacrificed during these great feasts to foreign gods and held all sorts of other activities. Now, the concepts and antipathy between Judah and the Persians in relation to these birthday festivals formed the basis of the abhorrence, which did develop amongst the churches against birthdays. Now, the fact of the matter is that birthdays were prohibited. And you'll find in the book of Job that Job's children were doing this. And they were part of the system of worship of the ancient Babylonian system. And it was tied into the worship of Ishtar, Baal, Ashtaroth. Now, Ishtar 1:5 says, and when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both under great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace, where white, green, and blue hangings, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple, the silver rings and pillars of marble, the beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. Verse 7 says, and they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. And verse 8 says, and the drinking was according to the law. None did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house, that they should do according to every man's pleasure. In those days they were regulated by the You see that right through in amongst the Celts as well. The Greek habit of the symposium is also seen from these Persian customs. You find that the regulation of drinking by toastmasters was part of this traditional system, and some people died in these symposiums. Now, the rabbinical comment is that they were allowed to drink of their own wine and they drank as they pleased. As a consequence, all sorts of concepts come out of this. The Persians were great drinkers, and Xenophon said of them, they drank so much that they cannot stand on their feet and must be carried out. Ahasuerus feared an uprising should his guests become intoxicated. The records of Xerxes show that he did not have a strong grip on the kingdom, but the concepts are that there is, as we understand it, a rebellion in the heavens, and that this problem within the host is reflected within the empire. And Esther 1 verse 9 says, also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And Esther 1:10 we read, on the seventh day when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Bisatha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zetha and Karkas, the 7 chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king. The Midrash says this refers to Vashti the queen. Vashti means the best. Vashti had prepared the women in the king's house, not in the house of the women, and the purpose of this was to dishonor the women. We are dealing with the proposition that there are spiritual concepts in everything that happens. The females here convey concepts in relation to the church, or are used to explain or convey the concept of a church and its relationship with the fallen host. Vashti was planning to cause the women to sin. According to the Midrash, the explanation was that Ahasuerus' plan was to cause the Jews to sin. And thus he would be assured that they would be punished by God and would not be restored to their land. He therefore refrained from coercing them to infract any law of the Torah, lest they have any excuse for their sins. He rather tempted them to take of the delegates who served at the banquet could do not compel them to do so. And you see that in Sponsina, footnote the rest of 1-8. Now the Jews see this as an example of trying to break their position with God. They see the activities of Ahasuerus in line with Vashti as improper in the first instance. But that is not the correct intention of the matter. The intention is to show that there was a select female, the queen and her entourage, who was selected as the best and placed in the kingdom as the wife of the king. That was Israel, the congregation, and thus she represents the congregation of Israel set apart to become the elect. Now on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry, he commanded these seven principal men. Perhaps the concept of the 127 derives from the fact that there are seven principal men there, and that these seven principal men had administrative commands over the 120 satraps. But this is conjecture. Esther chapter 1 verse 11, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. Spiritually, the seven representatives appear to equate with the seven angels of the churches of God who were commanded to bring Israel before God. Israel did not come before God. Israel rebelled and sinned. In Esther 1:12 we read that the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth and his anger burned in him. Now, these seven who appeared before the face of the king appear to relate to the prophets who saw the face of God, the presence or the angel of God. Seven prophets were involved, that is Samuel, Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. They literally stood before the face of God through the angel of the presence, and they were commanded to prepare Israel after Moses from the occupation onwards to bring Israel before God in right order, so that Israel might be crowned as the leading nation of the world, as the queen of the world. Now, Israel had a responsibility to prepare itself and did not do so. Esther 1:13 reads, then the king said to the wise men which knew the times, for so was the king's manner toward all that knew law and judgment. The Talmud understands this as astrologers, but the phrase is parallel with all that knew law and judgment. The law and the judgment is derived from the knowledge of the law through the Holy Spirit. This was given in the first part through the prophets. The Sonsino says, with all that new law and judgment, and probably means those who are familiar with historical precedents having the power of the law. This derives from Ibn Ezra's commentaries. For so were the king's manner towards all that new law and judgment, because all those who are righteous have the power of judgment. That is the function of righteousness. So those who know the law and judgment are righteous. The king was despised, that is, the power of God is well despised to those who know righteousness, law, and judgment. Esther 1:14 reads, and the next unto him was Kashina, Shetha, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face, and which sat the first in the kingdom. These are the principal prophets who stood before the face of God, as mentioned previously. Esther 1:15 says, what shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to law, because she hath not performed the commandments of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? So Israel did not obey the prophets. Israel did not prepare itself to come before the king. Israel had rendered itself naked by their behavior, and Vashti by her behavior had also done that. The Midrash commentaries say that she was naked, and the comments refer to the fact that she had only the crown on. She refused to come because of the way she was attired and that she personally saw her nakedness. There are a couple of commentaries which say that she had done nothing, but she was asked to appear naked wearing only the crown, which is why she refused. But when she looked in the mirror, she saw she was leprous in the face, but nobody else saw it. She refused to come because she saw her own nakedness through her rebellion. The rabbinical commentators get this far, but do not make the connection that it was Israel, through its rebellion, that was unfit, having rendered itself naked, and which could not go before God. This is of enormous significance. The rabbis have understood this for a very long time, yet continue to try to tie it down, and the Midrash starts to extrapolate into non-biblical positions in order to deal with the fact that they rendered themselves incapable of coming before God into judgment. Memucan was the last mentioned of the seven, and it is said from that he is an unknown character, and the rabbis identify him as Haman. The rabbis try and push the point that he was an ignoramus because he spoke first, because the rabbinical commentaries say that only an ignoramus speaks first. These comments come from Megillah 12b. Haman had reason to resent Vashti, so they are trying to work out who resented Vashti. Haman was an Agagite, and Agag was an Amalekite. We're dealing with the concept of Amalek versus Israel. It was Amalek who came upon Israel before they came into the Promised Land, and Moses had to stand there with his arms being held up in order that Israel would prevail against Amalek before they went into the Promised Land. So we're dealing with the concept of the very final part, before we enter into the Promised Land, dealing with the forces of Satan in the guise of Amalek. And that is why Haman the Agagite and Amalekite is represented here in the destruction of Judah. Now, there are two instances, the rabbis say. The Canaanites are ordered to be destroyed, and the Canaanites referred to incorporated the Amalekites. This is the third instance of the Amalekites trying to destroy the chosen. This event refers to the final destruction, the final wars before we go into Israel under Messiah for the millennial restoration. And this will develop as we go through the text. We are dealing with the final wars of the end. Now, Haman being an Amalekite in this text is not accidental. The book of Esther is talking about entities under Satan and under Christ, the church against the world to go into judgment and take control of the world. This is the argument of the last days, and it is quite sweeping in its impact. From comments from the Midrash and the Megillah, there are various comments as to why Haman had a dislike of Vashti, but there is no doubt why the dislike of the Jews was extant among the Amalekites. The Amalekites were the most ancient enemies of Israel, and we are dealing with the concept of the enemies of the elect right up to the last days. You see that these wars of the Amalekites, in effect, have been in operation from World War I right through the 20th century. So these wars of the end started in 1914. And it has been Israel that has kept this planet more or less free from this genocide, as we see. And we'll deal with that in the Holocaust papers as we publish them later. This judgment of Vashti was according to law. The rabbis say that according to law was added to Memucan because he knew that Ahasuerus did not want to kill Vashti. That is true. God did not want to destroy Israel for its rebellion. The law was given to Israel, and Israel is judged according to law. So Vashti is judged according to law. For as much as she has not done the bidding of King Ahasuerus by the chamberlains, Israel did not obey the law through the prophets. They did not obey God. And Esther 1:16 says, "And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen has not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king, Ahasuerus." Esther 1:17 reads, "For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes, when it shall be reported. The king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen be brought in before him, but she came not." What is being said is that the rebellion in one part of the host extends to the entire host, and the rebellion in Israel affected all. restoration of Israel was the primary step in the conversion of the planet. Israel had to be brought in so that all of the Gentiles could be brought in. But Israel, in the eyes of Judah, did not see the Gentiles as being brought into salvation. Now, the relationship between the woman and God, the woman that is the church and the woman that is the nation, is explained also in the law in the fifth commandment, or law in the first commandment, law in the fifth commandment, and law in the seventh commandment, which are published in the law series. And all of the law series are published under L1. Salvation was seen as being only for Israel, and yet they rendered themselves unfit to come into judgment. That is why Israel has to be punished, because the world will not be converted until Israel is converted. The world will not be brought into the millennial rest until all of Israel is brought into the millennial rest. Judah has to be forced to come into the millennial rest so that the world can come into the millennial rest. Judah will become Christian at the point of a sword. It will be the sword of God, and the truth of God will open their eyes in the last days. He will force their understanding through the Holy Spirit, and when that Spirit is poured out upon them, they will understand. But here they did not, and they willfully rejected God and rendered themselves unfit to come into the kingdom of God. In verse 18 we read, "Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day, and all the king's princes which have heard of the deed of the queen, thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath." From Esther 1:19 we read, "If it please the king that there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and that the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she." The law of the Medes and the Persians were that if the king made a decree, then it was unaltered. In this context, the premise comes from the concept that what issues from the mouth of God does not return empty, and that once God has commanded or expressed his will, it is. So that things occur by the divine utterance of God, and God does not make mistakes. God issues from his mouth a decree expressing his will, and that comes into being by edict, so that divine edicts are irreversible. Esther 1:20 reads, "And when the king's decree which he shall make shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honour, both to great and small." And in Esther 1:21 it says, "In the saying, please the king and the princes. And the king did according to the word of Memucan." The honour given to the husbands was that they were to come in to be the bride of Christ, and that all people ultimately will come in to the marriage supper of the Lamb as the bride of Christ. This is done in sequence, as seen before through the wise and the foolish virgins in the first and second resurrections. That has to be brought into this concept, so that Israel was dealt with in order that the point be made, and the marriage supper was given to other people better than Israel. That salvation was to go to the elect among the Gentiles. That was the concept. This has been dealt with in the marriage paper, the marriage supper of the Lamb. Esther 1:22 reads, "For he sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people." The concept of every people after their language are that the letters that were sent to every province and every people after their language was representative of the Bible and the epistles of the Bible. They were written in the language of the people concerned so that salvation can come to everyone. All Gentiles, because of the confusion. The rabbinical commentaries have to speak according to the languages of the people. So the relevance of the second part of the decrees are derived A vast number of languages were spoken in the Persian Empire in the time of Xerxes. The Midrash and Jewish commentators take the phrase to mean that if a husband and wife were of different race and language, they were to compel her to speak his tongue. That is the symbolism of us being given a new language when Christ comes. We will all be compelled to speak the language of our husband, the bridegroom. The intention was that if the customs of the husband conflicts with those of the wife, his customs were to prevail, because indeed Christ's customs will prevail on this planet. Perhaps Vashti claimed that it was contrary to the custom of her people that the queen display herself before her subjects. This is according to Ralbach. Perhaps this decree was added to the narrative of the incident to conceal the king's disgrace, according to Ibn Ezra. The comments more probably refer to the salvation being made available through the epistles of the Bible to all the nations, and that every man should bear rule in his own house and speak according to the language of his own people. The world was divided at the Tower of Babel, and confusion set on the world. So salvation rightly had to come to the world in different languages in order that salvation can be made available to everyone. It was not humanity's intent that different languages occur. It was inflicted on them. Therefore, salvation has to go out in those mediums to restore something that had been inflicted upon them. And you'll see that also in Revelation 14, verses 6 to 7. In Esther chapter 2, verse 1, we read, "After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her." This concept of Ahasuerus remembering Vashti was seen by the rabbis as being with remorse, realizing that she had acted properly in refusing to display herself. This is not correct. This comment of acting properly is that they do not understand what is involved in Israel failing to come before God. The comment is that God will always remember us, and that there are a number of comments in the Psalms dealing with this, when we will not be forgotten and God will restore us and uphold us, and these comments are taken up with the prophets. From Esther, chapter 2, verse 2, we read, "Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, fair young virgins sought for the king." From Esther 2, verse 3, we read, "And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, into the custody of Hege, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them." Esther 2, 4 reads, "And let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti." And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. Now, one can see the development as applies to the church. It was to send out to all the provinces to call the elect. These people were brought in and prepared, being given to the king's chamberlain. The elect were given to the angels of the churches, and officers were appointed to prepare them, and that was the function of the shepherds of the church. They were required to prepare the elect to be presented to the king, that is God, free of spot and blemish. These things were not being done, but that was the commandment. Now you see the process of purification dealt with in the paper Purification and Circumcision, number 251. They went out and did it in sequence over a long period, and one will see how the period develops. The comments on the portions and ointments were that they were given specific food and were prepared, or thus prepared. The food is, of course, the Word of God and knowledge of the law through the Holy Spirit. Esther chapter 2, verse 5 reads, "Now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite." Mordecai has two derivations. Mordecai has the origin, according to the rabbinical commentaries, of Meredachia, which means pure myrrh. It also has a derivative of Marduk, so that which was pure was misused or misapplied in the sense of misnamed. So the concept is that Mordecai meant pure myrrh, and his position has been misused. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. This lineage just raises all sorts of problems. Kish was the ancestor of Saul of the tribe of Benjamin, but Saul is not mentioned here. Now, Saul is the king of Israel and much more important than was Kish. So why was not Saul mentioned in this? Thus, the genealogy does not appear correct. It is important to note the names and what they mean. These names have spiritual significance. We read what the Talmudic commentaries say is the Midrashic approach to Esther from the Sonsino, page 128, in its note 6, Mordecai. Midrashically, the name is associated with the Aramaic Meredakia, or pure myrrh. Just as myrrh is the chief of the spices, so was Mordecai the chief of the righteous men of his generation. So we're talking about the Prince of Righteousness. Torah Tamima explains that according to the Talmud, his name from birth was Pethahiah. The name Mordecai was given to him later. Since this is a Gentile-sounding name, the Talmud and Midrash seek a Jewish origin to account for this appellation. As mentioned elsewhere, the man called Jesus Christ at birth was Yahshua, or Yahashua, which means righteousness. The name Jesus, or righteousness, the name Jesus, is a derivative of the Greek Yesu, which seems to be derived from the Hyperborean Celts, and which was another origin from the Celts of Jesus, and it has nothing to do with Hebrew or its concept. The name of the Messiah was changed. Now we go to the son of Jair, which means a son who enlightened the eyes of Israel with his prayer. Some of the rabbinical commentators say that these were taken from the lineage of Mordecai, but were his immediate lineage. This is probably the correct interpretation. It was done for a reason, to point towards Messiah as a son who enlightened the eyes of Israel with his prayer. The son of Shimei means a son whose prayer God heard, and the son of Kish, a son who knocked at the doors of mercy. This is a derivative of Jesus Christ saying, "I stand at the door and knock," which means also the concept of one of the names derived from the name Al-Tariq, the morning star. And you'll see that developed in the paper of Christ in the Quran. It's 163. He was knocking at the doors of mercy in order that mercy could be extended to all mankind through Israel. So these names are not just names. They point to Messiah and his effect. Mordecai is a prototype in Esther of Messiah. The Talmud takes these names to have homiletic meanings, since Scripture does not trace his entire lineage back to Benjamin in Megillah 12b. So they have a homiletic meaning, the Talmud says so, but they don't take the next step, that is, talking about Messiah, because there are all sorts of problems in this book. The reason the rabbis can't take Esther to its logical extension is that they stand condemned by it. Now we need to deal with the omission of Saul. If it was a lineage back to Benjamin, Saul was taken by Manoth Halevi to be intentionally omitted, since by his clemency to Agag he was responsible for Haman being born. It was Saul who spared Agag, the Amalekite, and because Saul spared Agag, the Amalekite, when God told him not to, we have the entire Agagite Amalekites ready to destroy Israel in the reign of Xerxes. So something we read of in Samuel, that Saul appears to be an act of clemency, where an act of Saul's act appears to be an act of clemency to one man, has a repercussion hundreds of years later, which almost results in the entire destruction of part of the Israelite people, that is, the Jewish people. Now that is taken back to the parallel of the clemency of the Canaanites and the Amalekites in the first instance. We'll almost destroy our people in the end. Before we enter the promised land and enter the millennial structure, we will go through near destruction because we did not purge unrighteousness from our people from the start. We did not obey the commands of God totally, and it will almost destroy this planet. And that is the concept that is being issued. So that little passage in 2:5 is a lot more profound than just a list of names. In Esther 2:6, we have, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with a captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Who was being carried away? Was it Mordecai that was carried away from Jerusalem with the captives, which had been carried away with Jeconias, king of Judah? If so, it makes him of extended age. So he would be dealing with Mordecai being of approximately 120 odd years, and we would deal with Zerubbabel, who was also established with the temple of nearly 120 years. We were talking about the same time frame of the life of Moses, and we are talking about the plan of salvation applied in three elements. The Sansino says, to whom does the relative pronoun refer, to Mordecai or to Kish? This is one of the most controversial questions in the book of Esther. They are assuming that Kish is a direct ancestor in the line, that is, his father, his father's father, and his grandfather's father, that is carried away, and not Kish, the ancestor of Saul. Hebrew usage seems to demand that it refers to Mordecai, but Mordecai's age becomes a difficulty. If he had been carried away in captivity, even as an infant with Jeconiah or Jehoiakim in 596 BC, he would be 122 years of age when he became prime minister in the 12th year of Xerxes' reign in 474 BC. He apparently enjoyed office for a considerable time afterwards from chapter 10, verse 2. This difficulty has led many to identify Ahasuerus with Cambyses, Darius, or one of the earlier kings of Persia. Others refer the relative pronoun to Kish, who would then be an immediate ancestor of Mordecai, his great-grandfather, and not the Kish of the book of Samuel. Many commentators think that carried away means only that his ancestors were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar and he lived in captivity because of the exile. The rabbis, however, ascribe unusual longevity to Mordecai, who was a member of the great Sanhedrin during the existence of the first temple and lived to see the second temple, according to Yosef ibn Nachmiash. So they're talking about mythological lineage and time periods for these people. Certainly we're dealing with concepts of extended age periods, which relate to the life of Moses, the construction of the temple and the restoration of the people, and they all deal with time frames which relate to the Jubilees and the plan of salvation. Esther 2:7, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's granddaughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. The rabbis try and muddy this up a bit and say he was actually married to her. That is not what it says. The whole process is that Hadassah was prepared and brought up as the daughter of Mordecai. Esther, as she became called, was his uncle's daughter, and the uncle of the son of the Jews, of the line of David, and was the daughter of Israel. That tells us we're dealing with a concept that extends beyond Judah. There are a number of things about Hadassah or Esther. Hadassah was a Hebrew name according to the Sansino commentaries, and Esther a Persian name given to her by the Gentiles. Hadassah is derived from the Hebrew word for myrtle, and Esther is derived from the Persian Astarte. that is star, from Megillah 13a. And the goddess Ostara, or Ishtar, derives from this text. In fact, the name of the nation Austria is derived directly from the name Ostar Alichi, which means the kingdom of the goddess Ishtar. According to some, this is the planet Venus from the Yalkut Shimoni, and according to others, it is the moon from Rashi and Aruch. So we have the naming applied to the moon and Venus. This is not an accident. The church is given of the morning star, and the church is the moon, which waxes and wanes and is married to the sun, which is Christ. That is why these names are applied. The star is, in fact, the Messiah, which comes out of Israel and out of the line of David, but is given to the church so that they are both the moon and share in the morning star, which is the rulership of the planet. That is the meaning of this text. Esther 2, verse 8 says, "So it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree were heard, and when many maidens were gathered together under Shushan the palace to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought also into the king's house to the custody of Haggai, the keeper of the women." In Esther 2, verse 9 we read, "And the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her her things for purification, with such things as belonged to her, and seven maids meet to be given her out of the king's house. And he preferred her and her maids under the best place of the house of the women." Ointments here refers to special food. From the Sonsina, it is not cosmetics, but special food which were part of the preparation. You see that in Daniel 1:5 also. The Hebrew word is the same as that for portions of food in 9:90 pointers in relation to the seven maidens given to her out of the king's house. So there are seven maidens given to the church, and those seven maidens were the seven eras of the churches under the seven spirits of God, the seven angels of the churches of God. The house of women is a function of the church or the religious function of Israel. Esther chapter 2 verse 10 reads, "Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it." Most of the church, that is Israel, remains hidden until the last day. It has not been made known properly, for Mordecai has charged her she should not tell it. This whole process is a charge of the mysteries of God. There are a number of things of the church concealed as the mysteries of God until the last day. Some of the commentaries are quite interesting in relation to seven maidens and then the names. The rabbis explain from Megillah 13a that with these maidens, she would count the days of the week in order to determine when the Sabbath fell. Rashi explains that she designated one maiden for each day of the week, and when the maiden designated for the Sabbath appeared, she knew that it was the Sabbath. They then turn that into an application on a weekly basis. They have the key, but do not unlock the door. The key is for the restoration to the millennial rest, to the Sabbath rest of Christ, but they do not take it through in a messianic context. The commentators extrapolate other texts in the Bible messianically, but Esther is not extrapolated messianically because it is clear, but subordinations. If you extrapolate Esther messianically, you come to the concept of the church and the removal of authority from Judah. That is why they are willfully ignorant in relation to Esther. The scribes who became the Pharisees deliberately hide the messianic application of Esther. When you go through that to charge to not to tell, Mordecai must have reasoned something like this. If Esther is chosen as queen, it can only be because God desires to make her the instrument of his purpose. That is correct. God desired to make Esther, the church, the instrument of his purpose. If then she reveals the fact that she is a Jewess, and therefore a member of a subject people, she'll prejudice her election, and therefore with that the possibility of becoming God's instrument, as according to Ralbad in his certain Sonsina. That's why the mysteries of God were concealed, because if they were explained and exposed early, the church would have been isolated and they would have been killed or exterminated. So the mysteries of God were to conceal the church up until the last days. The mysteries of God are revealed only in the last days, so that the church was not prejudiced until it got to this stage and the full number of the elect could be drawn out and allowed to survive. That was the function. This interpretation is suggested in the Midrash. He thought to himself, how is it possible that this righteous maiden should be married to a non-Israelite? It must be because some great calamity is going to befall Israel, who will be delivered through her. They understand it, but it is as clear as a bell, yet they do not take the next jump. This concealment has been so often condemned that it would be well to quote some of the many other explanations of it. Rashi comments that she did not declare her royal origin, i.e. that she was descended from the family of King Saul, so that the king might think she was of humble origin and send her away. That was their reasoning. But that is wrong. It was done to protect the elect. Esther 2 verse 11 reads, and Mordecai walked every day before the court of the woman's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. So this is Christ walking before the church every day in order to maintain a watch on the church. And remember, it is Christ that brings us without blemish to God. Now in Esther 2:12 we read, now when every maid's turn was come to go in to King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months according to the manner of the women, for so were the days of their purifications accomplished, to which 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with sweet odors, and with other things for the purifying of the women. Mordecai is derived from the concept of pure myrrh, and the Holy Spirit is directed through Christ in order to develop the elect. Given oil of myrrh for 6 months, and then other sweet odors under the direction of Christ and the host. Esther 2:13 reads, then thus came every maiden unto the king, whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. This preparation of the elect over the period is that one is purged, and the concept of cleansing and preparing is done on a continual and progressive basis. There is also another concept in these days from Nisan to Adar, because this process goes through edicts from the 13th of Abib, called Nisan, to 13 Adar, as we will see. It starts in the beginning of the sacred year and ends at the end of the sacred year. It's not an accident. These directives are all done in order to develop that process over a concept of a millennial plan. When it comes time for the elect to go into the king's house, what they desire will be given to them. The Holy Spirit is the desired thing taken with the elect. Esther 2:14 reads, in the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the women to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, who was called by name. This is a concept in its own right. The second house of the women, according to the Sansino, and the commentaries say that this second house of the women was where they would remain for the rest of their lives in practical widowhood. They would not be permitted to go into the world and marrying after consorting with the king. Ibn Ezra says that. So once more, one has consorted with the king. Once given the Holy Spirit, one does not go out into that world. You are shut off. You have been given the Holy Spirit, you are a prepared bride of Christ, and you don't go out into that world, and you don't sully your garments. So the Jews understood that, and some of us don't. Esther 2:15 reads, now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Haggai the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. Now Esther did not have a known ancestry here of Abihail, yet in the start it said she had no father or mother. The first instance is a reference to the fact that the elect are without genealogy. Their priesthood is not Aaronic, it is Melchizedek. Or of Melchizedek. This is a reference to Hebrews. The elect have no father or mother. They are not required to be Aaronic priests. They do not require a lineage from Aaron. They do not require to be Kohanim. They are part of the priesthood of Melchizedek forever. So even though we have lineage, we are not accounted to lineage for the purpose of the priesthood. When Esther went into the king, she required nothing. She said that she had whatever is enough. You have provided all that I need. She wanted nothing. Everything we are given for our salvation, to be part of the elect as priest of God and part of the Melchizedek priesthood, is given to us by the angels in charge of the churches. We are prepared and made ready, and it requires our diligence. We are given everything we need. How we prepare ourselves is the lesson. We will be given all we need. What we do during the week at home is up to us. If we do not study, we will not be prepared and we will fall short. We've got the time, and we've not got the time to waste on Sabbaths, slowing down the passage of information. We have to work. In Esther 2:16 we read, "So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign." Significance of the 10th month, Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, is imprecisely known. According to the commentaries, the names of the month in the book of Esther are those adopted by the Jews in Babylonia and still in use. Yerushalmi Mirosh Hashanah 1-2. Now this occurred in the 7th year, shortly after his ignominious return from his defeat in the Greek War. So this process was a concept of facing a war and of facing a defeat. There appears to be a time sequence which might or might not relate to the Bible, but that matters, requires further study. In Esther 2:17 we read, "And the king loved above all the women, and she obtained grace and favour in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So that is the answer to the problem. The elect became queen instead, in place of the ancient Israelite and the Aaronic priesthood. In Esther 2:18, "Then the king made a great feast unto all of his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast, and made a release to the provinces, and gave gifts according to the state of the king." Now this is the marriage supper of the Lamb. Esther 2:19 reads, "And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate." In verse 18, Esther's feast is the feast called in the celebration of the king's wedding with Esther from Lekach Tob. The release, according to the Talmud, is that Ahasuerus freed all of his provinces of taxes in honor of Esther. He hoped that she would reveal her kindred and her people because of this honor. The point is that release came through the church. This is the second time. The Sansino says in verse 19, this is one of the phrases in the book which is really difficult to understand. Why should there have been a second gathering of virgins? According to rabbinic interpretation, its purpose was to arouse Esther's jealousy and thereby induce her to declare a kindred in origin. Some have suggested these were the maidens who had not consorted with the king and they were gathered from the palaces they were kept and sent home. Yosef Lukacs. Others explain that these maidens were the servant girls gathered for Esther's household. It was customary to put on a new staff to serve a new queen, that is from Melchizedek. This is not what it means at all. The second gathering is of the virgins. One is gathered as the elect, set aside and married, and this is done at Pentecost. As the period of the seven churches develop, each of us is pulled out, and the second time is the marriage supper of the Lamb, when the Messiah comes again and develops us. The marriage supper itself is in two parts. They are saying that these are the women who were sent home. That is the parable of the wise and the foolish virgins that is actually being repeated in the rabbinical commentary. There were some virgins who were sent home and brought again. It doesn't make Esther the church jealous. It is simply the remainder of the church being pulled in as the foolish virgins in the second resurrection. There are two marriages. There are two resurrections, two positions which are given to Jesus Christ under God. That is why they cannot understand it, because they do not understand the function of the elect. But they say it. They understand that these things related to two lots of virgins, and they relate to two functions. But the church is not even comprehended. It appears that Judah cannot open up this book until the last days. Judah's understanding of the book of Esther appears to be a function of the first angel's message prior to the destruction of the Babylonian system, with the second angel on the last days of the beast and the third angel's message. Now this is dealt with in the messages of Revelation. Mordecai sits in the king's gate. The rabbinical commentaries say this means the large fortified entrance to the palace enclosures. Such gates have always been used in the East as courts of justice and meeting places of discussion and the exchange of news. They were the village pumps of the Orient, according to the Midrash. Esther advises Ahasuerus to engage Mordecai as the royal confidant, following the priests of the previous kings who had appointed Daniel to this post. Why was Christ made the Messiah? For us, God nominated Christ and set him as high priest and revealed the mysteries of God for us. This whole process or meaning is that Christ sat in the king's gate for the elect's sake. And Esther 2:20 says, Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandments of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. We obey the commandments of Jesus Christ. The rabbinical commentaries say that Esther had not made known her kindred. The purpose of the parenthetical statement in this place was to make it plain that Mordecai was not known to be a relative of the queen, and therefore conspirators were not likely to be on their guard against him. The rabbis explain that in spite of Ahasuerus' efforts to rouse her jealousy, Esther did not make known her kindred. The fact of the matter is that the full relationships of the elect are not known in the last days and deliberately disguised, and the rabbis do not understand that comment. But they get to one point. We've seen just how close they get, and then they pull back from the conclusions, which are obvious. Esther 2:21 reads, in those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hands on the king, Ahasuerus. We're talking about the rebellion of the host. We're talking about two of the covering cherubs who rebelled, those who reflected in Satan and the aeons, the lion-headed system, or being reflected in Satan and the aeons, the lion-headed system. Esther 2:22 reads, and the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. Verse 23 goes on, and when the inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out, therefore they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. In other words, they were removed from the book of life of the king. They were cursed. He was hanged on a tree as cursed, and that is the concept involved. They were removed from office. Esther 3, verse 1 says, after these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. This takes us back into the concept of the promotion of the servants of Satan, Haman and the Amalekites, the forces of the world, which are actually Haman himself, becomes the adversary in notation. So you have the adversary's descendants and the adversary becoming synonymous. The king of Tyre becomes synonymous with Satan. You get the Babylonian system synonymous with Satan. So here Haman becomes the adversary, and we'll see later how he becomes the adversary and he is referred to as the adversary. Esther 3:2. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him, but Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. And this concept then takes us to the war in the desert, where Christ was put before Satan, and he refused to bow down and worship Satan. Satan, even though the rulership of the planet has passed to Satan. Satan was the morning star of the planet. He was the ruler of the earth from Ephesians 2:2. But Messiah Mordecai was sent by God in order to deal with Satan. And he assumed rulership of the planet through his activities. His failure to be overcome by Satan, the god of this world, in 2 Corinthians 4:4, is reflected in the concepts involved here. Esther 3:3 reads, "Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, Why transgresseth thou the king's commandment? Esther 3:4 says, Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. He told them that he was a Jew. Esther 3:5 reads, And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And Esther 3:6 reads, And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai, wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. Esther 3:7 reads, In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th month of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. This casting of pur, the lot, has a religious significance. It's not a gambling activity. The casting of lot was in fact a religious exercise. They were casting lot against the people of Mordecai. They were casting lots against the church. And it is a process which goes from Abib, Nisan, to Adar. Through the entire sacred year. Every month of the sacred year they were under lot. They were under spiritual attack to the sacred that could be destroyed. Esther 3:8 reads, And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws, therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. So this authority, which is set up under the power of God, and all authority proceeds from the power of God, is being asked to wipe out the elect. There are some comments required about the casting of lots and diverse laws according to the rabbinical commentaries. The Sonsino says of Pur that no such word lot or there is no such word for lot. It Pur has been traced in Persian, but in Akkadian Pur is indeed a lot, usually cubes of wood, which the diviner would cast before the inquirer and determine the auspicious time for an undertaking by the signs that come out on top of the cubes, according to Darth Mikra. Such cubes were found in the ruins of the palace of Susa. Each one was 1 centimeter wide and 4.5 high. Even numbers indicated an affirmative reply and the odd ones a negative one. Certainness and sin over putting the markers. Now they seem to have gone from day to day and from month to month. Haman seems to have gone through the process of trying to cast for each day for the successive months. So in other words, there was a continual process of attack from day to day and from month to month undertaken in advance. The time frames thus had been set from the beginning. That's an important concept. Haman rejoiced, saying, My lot has fallen on the month that Moses died. But he did not know that Moses was also born in the month of Adar from the Talmud. Now, this concept has significance for the argument that they were trying to make regarding the death of Moses. The destruction of Israel relates to the death of Moses because Israel was introduced, or will introduce, the law under Messiah, and Moses was a symbol of the law as its instrument. Also, Moses died just before Israel went into the promised land, and that's another concept. Satan, through the world, symbolized by the Amalekites, had been trying to destroy Israel from the time of Moses. Moses died in that last period before they went into the promised land, and Israel mourned 30 days. So we're talking about the lot of the death of Israel and the Messianic system. The last 30 days is the war of the Amalekites in order to destroy Israel. The concept were that the destruction was established by Lot, and in the last days there is an attempt to destroy Israel from a perversion of the understanding of the allotted times, time frames and prophecies. The rabbinical commentaries talk about these comments of Haman about a certain people scattered abroad as a slander. His hatred of Mordecai became a slander against all Jews. So in other words, the elect were killed for Mordecai's sake. It is a hatred for the Messianic kingdom that causes the activity against the elect. There would be no requirement against the elect if there were no Messiah, and if there was not a new kingdom and a replacement. The Talmud says of Haman that no one knew better than he how to slander. There's only one who is the epitome of slander, and that is Satan. He's the maker of railing accusations, and these are the concepts that are being addressed. The concept here is that their laws are diverse, concerns the regulation of the people under the law, which is quite different to the laws that Satan had set up to regulate the planet. We have a concept of a divergence of law, or indivergence in law, and that the accusations are made that these people are under a different law than that which issues from the law of God. Haman is saying these people won't obey the laws that have been set up and Mordecai has issued, if you like, a set of laws, or the Jews have been issued a set of laws by the angel of the presence which proceed from the nature of God. And of course they are different to the surrounding world. It is a statement of fact, not an accusation of condemnation. Esther 3:9 reads, "If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries." This payment is quite a staggering amount. 10,000 talents of silver was, according to the Sonsino, when it was written, 3,600,000 pounds. The comments regarding this was that this sum, many times more valuable than it is today, owing to the much greater purchasing power of money, was equal to the annual revenue in silver of the whole Persian Empire, according to Herodotus. Perhaps Haman expected to obtain this sum from the plunder of the Jews they expected to exterminate, from which reason he expected to take the spoil of them for a prey. It is also possible that he would pay this amount from his own assets, since he was known to be fabulously rich, according to Ralbag. The rabbis have also come up with a numerological equivalent of the money to the equivalent of 165, which is the mathematical construction of the gallows, so there was an equal weight for the destruction of the people. And we'll deal with this matter later. The whole question relates also to the nature of the Holocaust and the destruction, attempted destruction, of Israel. And we'll deal with that in the paper, The Holocaust, The Fifth Seal of Persecution. Now, the rabbinical studies may perhaps become absorbed in mathematics and numerological sequences. We won't worry about them. In Esther 3:10, we see, "And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jew's enemy." So this ring was his signet ring. The Sonsino says, "The possession of which gave Haman full authority to act on the king's behalf." And he did have authority to act on the king's behalf, and this is later transferred to Mordecai in the work. The signet ring was given to Satan by God. He was given power over this planet. He was made the God, the Theos, or Elohim of this world, this earth. Esther 3:11 says, "And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee. The people also do with them as it seems good to thee. The silver is given back to him, and the king gave him back his money. He said, you've got them, and you have the money. You deal with them as it seems good to you." Now, remember, God gave Job's children to cite to be dealt. And the reason is dealt with in the paper on birthdays. Now, if God had taken the silver, he would have sold the people. The payment was not accepted. It was a judgment. He gave the lot to Haman, to Satan, in order to demonstrate the effect. God judged Satan by the way he dealt with the people. That was why there was no transference of money in this story. In the story here, the rabbinical commentators say Ahasuerus disliked the Jews as much as Haman. He alleged, or he allegedly thought, along the lines of, you might as well keep the money and do us all a favor. But that's not the spiritual significance of it at all. Esther 3:12. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written, according to all that Haman and the king's lieutenants, and to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus was it written, and sealed with the king's ring. Esther 3:13. And the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even unto the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. So we have the concept of casting lots. They've gone through every day of the sacred year, and they've not found a favorable lot. Yet it was set aside by lot that it was at the end of the days, the end of the sacred year, the 13th day of the month, that the destruction would occur. So the whole process has been set aside from the beginning of the world, and that these people might not affect us until the last days, and that is in the tribulation and the fifth seal, which we'll deal with in the Holocaust. Also, look at the paper outline timetable of the age. It will give you another idea of the sequence, and also the significance of the year 2000. In Esther 3:14, we read, the copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. But verse 15 goes on, the post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed. Shushan was an ancient city which preceded the Medes and Persians. And you see that paper in the fall of Egypt, the prophecy of Pharaoh's broken arms. Phase 1, Part 1, and 2, number 36. The Sunsuno says that the statement the king and Haman sat down to drink is the most effective piece of literary contrast. Other orders have been issued to destroy tens of thousands of human beings, but the king and his chief vizier callously enjoy a banquet, according to Dera Pasha. Esther 4:1 reads, when Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes, and went out into the midst of the city, and cried with a loud and bitter cry, and came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. One cannot go into the king's gate in sackcloth. Mordecai stood for the elect, and he humbled himself. He put on the clothing of a human being, he became a man, and humbled himself even unto death. And this is the story of Messiah. Nobody can go before the king's gate. Nobody can go before God as a human being. It is impossible to see him or go anywhere near him because of the apparel, the sin, and mortality renders you incapable. God is spirit and can't be seen, as Paul says in 1 Timothy 6:16. Only God is immortal. No man is seen or ever can see God. John 1:18 also said that no man has ever seen God. Esther 4:3 reads, and in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment, the decree came, there was a great mourning among the Jews, and fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. and called Esther for Hatach, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. Esther 4:6 says, so Hatach went forth to Mordecai into the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. 7. Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him and of the sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. Remember that Christ said to Peter that Satan had asked for him and he must sift him. Satan had the capacity to deal with the elect. Christ is telling Peter that Satan has asked God that he be given Peter in order that he might sift him and refine and deal with him, thus showing him to be inadequate. That will tell us that Satan is not simply a non-entity. He has access to God and is the accuser of the brethren, and Christ stands for us. He says these people God has given him will do this task, and he can get these people there. Satan is saying, no, he can't. These people are unfit to rule and be part of the system. And that's what the argument is all about. They are diverse, and they should not be a part of the system. God is mistaken. Right? That's what Satan's saying. God made a mistake, which is what the rebellion was all about in the first place. When we accuse one another, we do Satan's job for him. Esther 4, verse 8 says, also he gave him the copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther, and to declare it unto him, or unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him and to make requests before him for her people. Now that is the role of the church. We have to prepare ourselves to go before the throne of grace with boldness. The 24 elders from Revelation 4 and 5 are given responsibility for monitoring our prayers. It is they that place our prayers in the golden bowls. They place them before God, and it is we who intercede for our people. When we stop interceding for our people, they will be destroyed. Esther 4:9 reads, and Hatach came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. 10 goes on, again Esther spoke unto Hatach, and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. Verse 11, and all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. This concept is the calling of the elect. You cannot enter into the Holy of Holies unless you are called. And if you go into the Holy of Holies without being called, you will die. That was the punishment inflicted on Israel. Only Aaron could go in, and only once a year, and he atoned for the people of Israel. We have been called and chosen and nominated and prepared, and we can enter the Holy of Holies on a daily basis to intercede for the people. However, we have to prepare ourselves, and if our garments are not right, and if we are not spiritually correct, and we go before God, we will die. Esther 4:12, and they told, so that is the concept behind that, is those who take the Passover unworthily will die. And that's a very important concept. Of the New Testament. Esther 4:12, and they told to Mordecai Esther's words. The 30-day periods we find throughout the text are not without significance. There was a 30 days mourning for Moses, which related to the last days. Christ was not fit to come in to prepare the word of God and to proclaim the messages until he was 30. He preached 3 years. That is 2 years of time. 1 year under John the Baptist. And he commenced his ministry for 2 years. Esther 4:13. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape from the king's house more than all the Jews. There is no place of safety." One is not going, and you see that in the paper, the place of safety. One is not going to escape in the king's house more than any of the other people. That is what Christ, Mordecai, is saying to the elect, Queen Esther. You are not going to get away with this. You are not going to be there while these people die. You are going to have to work and pray and fast to save your people. That is why the message that came out of the sects teaching a place of safety or rapture was heresy. You see also in the paper the millennium and the rapture. Such teaching failed to prepare our people, and we didn't do our job, and we didn't save our people. We have to work. Esther 4:14 reads, "For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this. God will raise up somebody else. The stones of the street will cry out if we do not. If we do not do our job, God will simply destroy us and raise something else up, as he will do and is doing now. How do you know that you were not called to do just this? That you came to your royal kingdom, that you were made a king and a priest, you are part of the Melchizedek priesthood for this time." Esther 4:15 reads, "And Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer." 16 says, "Go, gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." So there is a process which is set up such that by fasting, contrary to the structure of this planet and contrary to the will of the world, we have to go into God in order to deal with the problem. If I perish, I perish is a simple way of saying, so be the will of God. Esther 4:17 reads, "So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. This is not that the world here is commanded, but the concept is that Christ is there working daily according to the requests of the prayers of the saints. As we work and ask and seek and direct each other in request of Christ, so the angelic host assists us. It places a power in our hands that has hitherto not been understood." That's why Christ said we could pick up mountains and throw them into the sea if we have the faith. We did not put the mountains there, but we can throw them into the sea if we have the faith. So it means we can change the established order of things through faith. Esther 5:1 reads, "Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house, over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house, over against the gate of the house." These concepts are of the establishment also of the sign of Jonah, where you see the 3 days of Messiah's ministry as the concept of the church being prepared. Also in the last days, there is another period during the witnesses upon which the salvation of this planet depends. The first, second, and third angels' messages set up a sequence of activity in the last days. These are all covered in the papers, the sign of Jonah, and the history of the reconstruction of the temple, the witnesses, and also the messages of Revelation 14. And you'll see in the end process also some of that is covered in the paper, the last paper. The church is not going to be sitting back in the last days while the witnesses are speaking in Jerusalem. The church is not going to be away somewhere on a holiday. We are not going to be on our knees in sackcloth and ashes, fasting and praying and getting this planet ready so we are not destroyed and it is hard work. It's not much fun. It will not be fun. The point is that it is not a one-man band. Christ did not do it on his own. The witnesses will not do the work on their own. The future of the churches depends on the elect and not just the ministry. The nation depends on us and our prayer and fasting and study. And there is precious little being done of it at the moment. Esther 5:2 we read, "And it was so, when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight, and the king went out to Esther, the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter." It was through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ that we became able to enter and touch the golden scepter. We entered the Holy of Holies and touched the golden scepter. That had not been allowed to be done up until that time. Esther 5:3 reads, "Then said the king unto her, What wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be given, be even given thee to the half of the kingdom." This is taken as being a point of largesse, a grandiose complimentary gesture, not intended to be taken seriously, according to the Sestina and the rabbinical commentaries. However, that is not what it means at all. The half of the kingdom had been removed through the rebellion. 12 of the Elohim had fallen, and it was half of the kingdom that was going to be given to the elect. The church was to inherit that part of the kingdom that the fallen host had obviated. So a third of the kingdom had fallen to the Elohim, but at the highest position, it was even to the half of the council. The additional point is that the human race make up an additional amount to the angelic host, so that's not an idle statement. We do not know what the numbers are. We don't know what the census is because we've not taken it. We're not privileged to know. But this comment, even to the half of the kingdom, indicates the size involved. But not more particularly, there is a specific thing happening where the human half of the creation, is superimposed on the angelic, with the angelic half, on the loyal host. And this is dealt with in the paper, The City of God. You'll see the whole procedure develop in that paper. Esther 5:4 reads, "And Esther answered, If it seems good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him." Esther 5:5 reads, "And the king said, Cause Haman to make haste, for then he may do Esther has said, or do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, "What is thy petition? It shall be granted thee, and what is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed." Then answered Esther, and said, "My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition, and to perform my request, that the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said." So we have two functions. They come the first day to a banquet of wine, another banquet the second day. So we're looking at 2 days involved in the initiation. This process over 2 days, the marriage supper and 2 banquets, covers the concept again of the resurrections. It also covers the concept of the second banquet, the second phase. We're dealing with the resurrection of the dead, the judgment of the angels, and the judgment of the entire host. The church then has the process ready, and Satan is being summoned under the direction of God. Satan comes under the judgment. You'll see that in the resurrection papers. The paper on the judgment of the demons and the fallacy of the third resurrection, the paper of the soul, and the paper of lost sheep and the prodigal son. Now, these papers show you what's going to happen in the second resurrection, where all of the creation will be judged. And from 1 Corinthians 6:3, "You know, you're not, we shall judge angels." Now, Esther 5:9 reads, "Then went Haman forth that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, but he stood not up nor moved for him. He was full of indignation against Mordecai. 5:10, nevertheless Haman refrained himself, and when he came home, he sent and called for his friends and Zeresh his wife. And Haman told them of the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the things wherein the king had promoted him. And now he had advanced him above the princes and servants of the king. The 10 sons are probably only the sons of Zeresh, according to the rabbinical commentaries. He probably had a multiplicity of children through concubines as well. And 5:12, we read, Haman said, moreover, yes, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet which she had prepared but myself, and tomorrow am I invited unto her also with the king. These comments are to build a story of what is happening to Haman. The significance is that this sequence is being developed so that the church will deal with these people on demand. Know thee not that ye shall judge angels, 1 Corinthians 6:3. This is a concept that those people will come in the direction of us. But also Christ did not worship Satan, which is another important text on this, and Christ has another significance. And you look also at the paper, The Pre-existence of Jesus Christ. Number 2:43. Now, in Esther 5:13, we read, yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate. In Esther 5:14, then said Zeresh his wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon, then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. Chapter 6, verse 1 reads, on that night could not the king, and he commanded to bring the book of records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Verse 2, it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. Verse 3, and the king said, what honor and dignity have been done to Mordecai for this? And said the king's servants that minister unto him, there is nothing done for him. You recall there was a rebellion in the heavens as well. Esther 6:4, and the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman was come into the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai in the gallows that he had prepared for. So we're talking basically about the concept of the elect and the fact that Israel had become idolaters. Satan was joyous that Israel had become idolaters. And there is also a long-term aspect of the invitation. The point is also that Satan was continually undermining Israel, and Israel had been sent into captivity. Israel was dispersed completely. And we also should look at the fact that Messiah was part of the loyal host, which stood firm in the rebellion under the two leaders of the fallen host, one of whom was Satan. Then Judah had been sent into captivity and then again into captivity for idolatry. So we also see Judah sent into captivity and then again for idolatry. The concept is that they have been invited in. Satan also had been invited in. Mordecai was placed in as Christ was placed. And this is represented by the fact that Haman was going to destroy Mordecai. This is a parable about the destruction of Jesus Christ by hanging him on a stake on the cross. Esther 6:5, and the king's servant said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court, and the king said, let him come in. And Esther 6:6, so Haman came in, and the king said unto him, What shall be done unto the man whom the king delights to honour? Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to honour more than myself? This shows arrogance in a position of saying that there is no one around who is better than self. And this is the position that Satan held as a covering cherub. He put himself above every other member of the council of the Eliyim. He was made the covering cherub, but he tried to ascend the Mount of God. He tried to make himself equal with God, and Christ did not do that. This is the concept of the arrogance involved and is reflected in Philippians 2:6. Esther 6:7, and Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honour. 6:8, let the royal apparel be brought which the king used to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head. This horse that the king rides upon is the power of God. A Messiah comes on a white horse in the last days, symbolizing the power of God through the Holy Spirit. All these people existed on crowns of gold, thrones of gold, and they were appointed by God. Esther 6:9 reads, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delights to honour, and bring him on horseback through the streets of the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honour. Esther 6:10 says, then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew, that sit at the king's gate, that nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. 6:11 says, then took Haman the apparel and the horse, and arrayed Mordecai, and brought him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delights to honour. We have a concept here that Messiah has qualified to replace Satan as the morning star. He has been honoured by the king above Satan, and he has made Satan acknowledge the fact that Christ has qualified to replace him. There's no doubt that Satan now knows that Christ is going to be the new morning star and that his time is short. That is a function of the rebellion of the host, and he has been made to acknowledge that fact, and that angers the dragon. Esther 6:12, and Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his house, mourning and having his head covered. Christ went away to the house of the king. This concept of Haman hastening to his house, mourning and having his head covered, is a sign of mourning from Samuel 15:30. The Targum notes that fact. What is represented is that Haman having his head covered has been cut off. So Haman hastened to his house and had his head covered, was placed and bound as he is bound in the millennium from Revelation 20 verse 2. Esther 6:13, and Haman told Zeresh his wife and all his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh's wife unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him. So if you are a son of God, if you are of the line of David, you can do X, Y, and Z. Satan used these words against Christ in the desert. Esther 6:14 says, and while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hastened to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared. Esther 7:1, so the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther and the queen. And verse 2 says, and the king said unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther, and it shall be granted thee, and what is thy request, and it shall be performed, even to the half of the kingdom. Then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favour in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we have been slow for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. This is a very difficult text. The rabbinical commentators say it is a very difficult text to interpret, because we are talking about the adversary here. We will examine ourselves. The petition here is that Esther is saying that we, the elect, are sold to be destroyed. If we had been sent in to be bondmen and bondwomen to be servants, I, she representing the church, would have said nothing, because our role is to be servants to God. We are slaves to God. We, through the adoption, are being made sons of God, where Israel was simply slaves of God. Moses was a servant of God, where Christ was a son of God, and therefore Christ had a higher rank than Moses in the structure. We are given sonship, as is Moses on the resurrection. Now, if the sonship was taken off us as the church, and we were simply put back to be bondservants, then who is to object? Why would we object to being put into the second resurrection? Because we would simply be bondservants of God. This is not a valid objection. However, the aim is not to put us in the second resurrection, but to destroy us as a spiritual force. That is why we battle with Satan. The adversary's aim is to destroy us as a force and to overthrow God and take command of the universe. That is the meaning of the text, "I would have held my peace, for the adversary is not worthy that the king be endangered." We do not hold our peace because the adversary is less than our God, and we serve our God. The adversary is not worth that position, and thus we fight him in order to protect the system and our God. So we go before and establish our relationship with God through Jesus Christ in order that the adversary be overthrown. Esther 7:5. Then the king Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, "Who is he and where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so?" 7:6. And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, in his garden, and Haman stood up to make requests for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. In the end, the demons make requests of us because we judge them. They are judged by what we do. From 1 Corinthians 6:3, "Know ye not that ye will judge angels?" And they will petition and plead clemency from us in Jesus Christ. That's what this is all about. The issue of clemency will be at our request. Esther 7:8. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the palace, or the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereupon Esther was. And said the king, "Will he force the queen also before me in this house?" And as the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Falling on couches is a significant point. Satan has taken the couch of Esther and become part of the couch, and that is what Christ is saying in Revelation to the Thyatira. They will throw those of that church on a couch with Jezebel. Hence we're dealing with a mixture of false religions. The view of Haman forcing Esther is that of forcing the church or raping the church. That's the 7:9 says, "And Habonah, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, 'Behold also, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman.' And the king said, 'Hang him thereon.'" 7:10. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. So the fate sought for Christ and the host is suffered by Haman or Satan, the adversary. 8:1. "On that day did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her." The whole house, the whole part of the morning star, the planet, is given away. It is taken from Satan, one morning star, and given to Christ and the church. And we share in the morning star and the rulership of the planet. Esther 8:2, "And the king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it unto Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman." Christ is set over the house and given the signet ring of the rulership of this planet for the elect. That is what Paul is saying, and that is what John is saying. The New Testament's whole purpose is that Christ is made morning star and he achieves position as the high priest for the elect. Esther 8:3, "And Esther spake yet again before the king and fell down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite and his device that he had devised against the Jews." Esther 8:4, "Then the king held out the golden scepter towards Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king." Verse 5 says, "And said, 'If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the things seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews which are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that shall come unto my people? How can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Then the king Ahasuerus said unto Esther the queen and to Mordecai the Jew, Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him they have hanged upon the gallows because he laid his hands upon the Jews. Write ye also for the Jews as it liketh you in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring. For the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. This action issues from the will of God. This is when Revelation says, Those who are of the synagogue of Satan, whoso they are Jews and are not, I will make them bow down and worship you. Worship here is prostration in the sense of acknowledgement of authority. The actions will reveal the concept of what true Judaism is, what the true salvation and the position of Israel is. It is of heart and is through the Holy Spirit and the elect. It is not through the Talmud. Verse 9 says, Then were the king's scribes called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day thereof. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded unto the Jews, and to the lieutenants and the deputies and rulers of the provinces, which from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, unto every province according to the writing thereof, and unto every people after their language, and to the Jews according to their writing and according to their language. It is not an accident this is in Sivan. The thing that falls in Sivan is generally Pentecost, mission of the church after its preparation. Whether there are any other concepts which develop from Sivan is uncertain. More study on the full significance of the 23rd of Sivan is needed. Esther 8:10, And he wrote in the king Ahasuerus' name and sealed it with the king's ring and sent letters by post on horseback and riders on mules, camels and young dromedaries. When the king caused the Jews, which were in every city, to gather themselves together and to stand for their life, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish, all the power of the people and province that would assault them, both little ones and young, and women, and to take the spoil of them for prey. So this is a concept of riders being dispatched on horseback. We're dealing with the concept of this development up to the final destruction of Revelation. It's the 8:2. Upon one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, namely upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, the copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, and that the Jews should be ready against that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Verse 14 continues, So the posts that rode upon mules and camels went out, being hastened and pressed on by the king's commandment, and the decree was given at Shushan the palace. We're getting ready. The situation has changed. The letters which are the epistles of the New Testament and the book of Revelation have told the end from its position. After the church has given its position and given the apostles and the prophets, Revelation is developed as the last work, and the whole structure is shown, and how the plan of salvation is changed. Messiah comes at this process at the end of the heavenly signs and takes over. The position is reversed. The day of the wrath of the Lord is a concept being developed here, where the destruction sought to be inflicted on the elect is in fact used to deal with the planet. We can also look at the paper, The Day of the Lord in the Last Days. Esther 8:15 says, And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. And blue and white is not accidental. Blue and white symbolize truth and purity as royal apparel. First, humbly, sackcloth and ashes, symbolized by the linen of the atonement sequence, Messiah humbled himself as the Messiah of Aaron and was killed. Whereas he sacrificed himself to be crucified, he now goes forth as a king, Messiah, with a sword of truth and a horse of the power of God. We're also dealing with a great crown of gold and the robe of fine linen and purple being the symbols of his kingship as a king Messiah. Esther 8:16 reads, The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. Esther 8:17 says, And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. We're dealing with the prophecies in Isaiah. We're dealing with the concept of the Gentiles coming into Judah. All of Israel comes back to the problem where 10 men grab hold of the robes of a Jew saying, "We hear the Lord is with you." These concepts were that they become Jews in understanding. They become members of the elect. And Esther 9:1 reads, "Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandments and his decree drew near to be put in execution, in that day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them. The Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king, Ahasuerus, to lay hand on such as sought their hurt, and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all people. They will spread through the peoples and will emerge in the last days as young lions, as the text suggests. Judah will fight at Jerusalem," from Zechariah 14:24. Isaiah 66 shows how the restoration of the last days will occur in the world. Israel will be sought out and returned. The Sabbath and new moons will be restored, from Isaiah 66:23, as will the feasts be restored, from Zechariah 14:16-19. That's 14:16-19. Esther 9:3 reads, "And all the rulers of the provinces and the lieutenants and the deputies and officers of the kings helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them." Esther 9:4, "For Mordecai was great in the Lord's house, and his fame went out throughout all the provinces, for this man Mordecai was greater and greater. So of Messiah's kingdom there shall be no end." Esther 9:5 reads, "Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would under those that hated them." Esther 9:6 reads, "And in Shushan the palace the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. Esther 9:7, "And Pashandatha and Dalphon and Aspatha and Paratha and Adalia and Aridatha and Pramashta and Arisai and Aridai and Vajazatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they, but on the spoil laid they not the enemy." This is a mouthful. By tradition, it is said all in one breath, and it is listed in the Masoretic text in this way. The Masorah prescribes the names of the 10 sons of Haman be written in the perpendicular column on the right-hand side of the page, with the Vav, I, and the and on the left-hand side. This is probably derived from the tradition that 10 sons were hanged from the tall gallows one after the other. It is also customary for the reading of the Megillah on Purim to read the names of the 10 sons in one breath because they all died together according to the Targum. And that's not accidental. The 10 sons of Haman represented the concept of the empirical system of the last days. We are dealing with this system right through to the end. The 10 sons of Haman are all listed in one breath because they form the union of the 10 kings in the last days. That is why they're all together in the Masorah and why the whole structure holds together. They're all destroyed together as they received their power together in the last days in the empire of the beast. That is what the text is all about. That is why these people know at the end that the end result of the satanic system and the empirical structure set up from the Babylonians results finally in the last days in the union of the 10 kings. The rabbinical commentaries quite clearly understand that these texts relate back to the image of the beast in Daniel chapter 2. There is no question that the rabbis understand that is that image that is being contemplated through the book of Esther. So we have a continual process of the development of the empire under Nebuchadnezzar, being at the head of gold, through under the silver of the Medes and Persians and on through, so that the Amalekites merely represent the military portion of this system. That is, the satanic forces involved occurring under each empire and developing through the empires. Certainly these 10 sons, being the end result of the satanic, are destroyed in one breath in the last days, is the understanding of the end destruction of the empire of the beast and the 10 tanners of Daniel 2. These are the 10 horns that we see in Revelation on the 7 heads having 10 horns. They both relate to the same thing. They are the last stages of the empire of the beast, which is the Babylonian system, which encompasses the entire time of the Gentiles. That is why these comments are made about the outer court. Haman comes into the outer court because he is allowed to come. Jerusalem is given over to the Gentiles, and the outer court is trampled for 42 months. And that is another concept which arises out of this text. The 500 men are traditionally listed as being the personal household of Haman. That is the personal household of Satan. That relates then to the recreation of another 500 under the elect who will take their places. These ordinations from Christ to the 12 and the 30 to 70 down through the 144,000 all have a specific relevance to portions of the host where they take over the responsibilities and the authority of the fallen host. All are nominated and all are appointed and ordained as kings and priests within this order. There is no spoil. None of the satanic system will be taken by the elect and taken into the millennium. No spoil will be touched. The commentary said that of the spoil they laid not their hand. The Jews had but one thought, self-protection, and this piece of information stresses the fact. And you see that from Eshkol HaKof. That is relevant in that for the self-protection of the elect, nothing of the satanic system is taken as spoil to go into the Messianic kingdom. It is all left behind. Esther 9:11, on that day the number of those that were slain in Shushan, the palace, was brought before the king. And the king said unto Esther the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. What is thy request further? And it shall be done. Esther 9:13 reads, then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also, according unto his decree. And that Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. And the king commanded so to be done, and the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day also of the month Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan, but on the prey they laid not their hand. So on the second day we have another 300 slain, and they did not take the spoil. Esther 9:16. But the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of their foes 75,000, but they laid not their hands on the prey. We're talking here of the sabbatical rest. Throughout the kingdom they killed 75,000 people. Esther 9:17 reads, on the 13th day of the month, Adar, on the 14th day of the same rest of the day, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. In verse 18, but the Jews that were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day thereof, on the 14th thereof, and on the 15th of the same they rested, made it a day of feasting and gladness. So they came to the full moon. By the full moon of Adar, they had achieved their aim. Therefore the Jews of the villages that dwelt in the unwalled towns made the 14th day of the month Adar a day of gladness and feasting and a good day, and of sending portions one to another. This concept of sending portions one to another and of unwalled towns has a relationship back to the settlement of Israel, because the determination of the walled and the unwalled towns is not done, as you would imagine, at the time of Xerxes in the Babylonian captivity. The rabbinical determination of the walled and unwalled towns under this feast of Purim are determined from what cities were walled and unwalled at the time of Joshua. That is highly significant because it balances up the numbers. The numbers outside of Israel would be greater if it was later than beforehand, but it is not done according to that system. It is done as at the time of Joshua, when Israel was first taken. So we are talking about the capture of the Holy Land in establishment in a secondary phase, using the first occupation of Israel to establish the concepts of the second occupation of Israel. This is an extended time frame. The understanding of the religious authorities during this period was that it was placed back in the days of Joshua, and that is extremely important. But also, look at the paper, The Fall of Jericho. Now, Esther 9:20 reads, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of the king, Ahasuerus, both nigh and far, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same yearly. This is a prophecy that goes out under direction of Christ 9:22 reads, "As the days when the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to joy, and from mourning unto a good day, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, and of sending portions one to another, and gifts to the poor. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun, and Mordecai had written unto them. Because Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head, that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. This is a judgment. As you seek to destroy the elect, so you will be destroyed. Also, it is of significance that this period of rejoicing is in Adar, 2 weeks prior to the coming of the new year in one Abib. Thus, the return in the last days and those activities can be expected to occur before the beginning of the millennial system. Now, Esther 9:26. Wherefore they call these days Purim after the name of Pur. Therefore, for all the words of this letter and that which they had seen concerning this matter and which had come unto them, Esther 9:27, the Jews ordained and took upon them and upon their seed and upon all such as joined themselves unto them, so as it should not fail, that they would keep these 2 days according to their writing and according to the appointed times every year. Now, these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. Now, these days of Purim should not fail from among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. This is a function of the Jews, enjoined upon everyone who joins Judah. This tells us what is going to happen to the Feast of Purim when Messiah issues his decrees on the restoration. It has nothing to do with us now. He looks forward to the restoration. Esther 9:29 says, "And Esther the queen, the daughter of Abihail and Mordecai the Jew, wrote with all authority to confirm the second letter of Purim. And he sent the letters unto all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth, to confirm these days of Purim and their times appointed according as Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen had enjoined them, and as they had decreed for themselves and for their seed the matters of the fastings and of their cry. And the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. Therefore the church will enjoin the Feast of Purim upon itself under Messiah. The Feast of Purim will be kept in its entirety during the millennium, it will be added during the millennium." 10:1, "And the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea, and all the acts of his power and of his might and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, were unto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was next unto king Ahasuerus and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people and speaking peace to all the sea." The end of the book of Esther is highly significant. The king laid a tribute upon the land. The commentaries say that in verse 1. This chapter is an appendix or postscript to the book, emphasizing the power of Ahasuerus and the glory that was thereby reflected on Mordecai as his first minister. This is not extrapolated by either mainstream Christianity or the Jews, because it establishes the absolute subordination of Jesus Christ. The Christian commentators cannot deal with it, and the Jewish commentators cannot deal with it, because it establishes Christ as a prime minister on an equality and replacement of Satan. The thought is that Ahasuerus and Mordecai, as prime minister, succeeded in conquering many provinces until he was able to accept tribute from the lands near his kingdom as well as from the distant isles of the sea, according to Melbourne. Since the Hebrew word elsewhere, or everywhere else, means forced labour, a better translation is imposed forced labour. You see that. Tough time on Exodus 1:11. According to the Targum, it refers to the head tax from Uruk. The Targum says that it is a head tax. And what is the head tax? It is the tax taken on the Day of Atonement as a temple tax. What happens is that the church under Messiah issues the temple tax again on the Day of Atonement on all people in all provinces of the empire. The system of the atonement taxes means that every person is entered under the kingdom of God, and salvation is extended to all people under payment of the temple tax at atonement. That tribute means that salvation goes not only to the Gentiles through the elect and the church, it becomes a mandatory levy on all nations when all nations come under the rulership of Jesus Christ at the end. That is the significance of the additional chapter of the book of Esther. You see now that the book of Esther is not a story about a woman who becomes the queen of Persia. Once we understand the book of Esther, we understand the sheer magnitude of the book of Revelation as it develops in the Old Testament. The whole structure built through Jesus Christ emerges with the church hand in hand in order to save the planet.